everyone. Welcome again to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. My name is John McAdam. I am here with Sean Goodwin. Sean, how's everything going?
Oh, it's fantastic. We get to talk about Battle Royals today. What's more exciting than that?
You know, but before we get into Battle Royals, I wanted to say this. Last week, I am still buzzed over the show we did last week. We had Brian Last, who was a great guest. We had an absolutely awesome discussion about one of my favorite things to talk about, 1983, the year before the real war broke out. And a good friend of mine on Facebook, Tyler Judd, he had one of his friends who was unfortunately passed away, had a letter published in one of the After magazines in the early 80s. And I grabbed the magazines I had. I looked for it. I didn't find it. But while looking through these letters, I saw something from a guy who lived in Newport, New Hampshire. I don't even know where that is. And he was complaining about Roddy Piper's conduct on the WTBS show. And he was like, oh, announcers shouldn't be acting like that. And if there was ever a neon sign that I missed that, wow, man, these territories are going bye-bye on their own, technology's doing it. I mean, I should have seen that in 1982, but I totally didn't.
Great point. There's like a bunch of stuff in there. I was like, which one am I supposed to answer?
I have this habit of catching people by surprise. So, Brian, we're going to talk about not wrestling for about 2 minutes. Have you ever, like, we're towards the end of the summer now. It's like the home stretch. We're almost done. We're about to cash in our Sundays at the beach or Sundays watching football. Like, do you ever associate, like, a particular summer with a particular album?
Particular summer with a...
I know, way out. I did not give Brian, Sean, a warning at all on this. I'm catching him totally by surprise.
I think it was 1980, and it was, what was the song? Cool in the Gang, Celebration.
Okay, that was summer of 80 right there. So here's the thing, like for me, the summer of 1981 was totally about Billy Squier's Don't Say No. I can't help it. It was on the radio all the time. 1990, I now have a cassette deck in my car. I can control what I listen to. And summer of 90 was about the Smithereens 11. Fast forward 11 years, I have a CD player in my car now. And summer of 2001 was about Weezer's Green album. Summer of 2018. I have my MP3 player in my car, and I am listening to, nonstop this summer, 40-year-old music from a band called the Buzzcocks. So I have transformed the summer of 2018 somehow into this band that broke up in like 80 or 81. But in 10 years, I'll be like, oh, yeah, that was the summer of the Buzzcocks.
I'll go you one worse. I'm doing Rory Gallagher right now.
Rory Gallagher. I'm not familiar with him.
Oh, the great Irish blues man.
Oh, okay. All right.
From the 70s. He just one of those really influential Irish bluesmen from early to mid 70s. I believe he drank himself to death, something to do with pills or something like that. But
that's
great, great
thing.
Talent. Any guitar player from Slash to anybody, they'll tell you how great Rory Gallagher was.
No, you see, I need to strive to be a more well-rounded individual such as yourself, because I listen to like one thing and that's it. And now I say it all sounds the same, except it totally does. But, I emailed Sean this week and, we went over some ideas for the show. But one thing I wanted to talk about was Battle Royals. When I first started watching wrestling, when I was up here in Boston, I want to say this is like March, April of 1976. And they announced this thing that they're having a battle royal at the Boston Garden. And they made this thing sound like it was going to be just the greatest thing in the world. The 20 top guys in the WWF, minus Bruno Sammartino, were all going to get in the ring and they were all going to fight. They were all going to fight each other.
It looks so good on paper, doesn't it?
It sounded really good on paper. It sounded like a dream come true on paper. And, not only do you get a title shot against Bruno Sammartino, but you get 10 grand. And even as a kid, like, I knew what 10 grand could buy you. It would be a lot in 1976. So I'm begging my dad, please, dad, take me to this. And he's like, you know, no way. He didn't want me watching wrestling in the first place. Never mind, he's going to bring me to the Boston Garden. But I finally got to see, it, like I said, it sounded like a dream match. Anytime they, like, you know, dangled that carrot, Battle Royal, oh, my God, that sounds so good. And in 76, they had, like, side stories why you wanted to see this. Ivan Putski was going to use that $10,000 to import his babushka, his girlfriend, from Poland. And superstar Billy Graham would go out and be like, I hate Ivan Putski. I'm going to ruin that for him. And just, you know, you had these little things like the executioners were going to soften up Sir Dan and Parisi, just all kinds of little side storylines that made it sound like this was going to be the greatest thing in the world. So what was
more important than the battle,
battle Royal?
More important than the Battle Royal. Is it Putski or Putski?
I believe it's Putski. I mean, Ventura.
Because Gorilla always did Putski.
Ugh.
But Jesse always did Putski.
I think, you know what, now it's like kind of rolling on the Ivan Putski's voice in my head, and I think he always kind of said Putski. But, like, I'm really dialing up the memory here. Now,
the problem with the Battle Royal is the same problem with the scaffold match. It looks great on paper, two guys up in the scaffold wailing away each other, you know? When you think about it that way, sure. Then when it happens, it's four guys hugging onto the scaffold for dear life, crawling forward, terrified the whole time. You know, in a battle royal,
terrified.
A battle royal is great for the announcement, and it's great for the first 30 seconds. After that, it's too much. You're wasting guys.
Too little.
No, but I'm saying the whole thing is spread out over in the corner, so you don't know, so you're wasting guys. That's why when Patterson wisely went to the Royal Rumble format, because it spread it out. And then he could dictate where the focus is going to be, as opposed to the Battle Royal, where you can't do that.
That is an excellent point. I was going to say, I've seen some really good Royal Rumbles. I'm waiting for my first good Battle Royal.
Yeah, I don't know. The famous one was, I guess, was it San Francisco?
Oh, Los Angeles. Actually, I think
it was
San Francisco had one, too.
So that was the big, quote, $100,000, you know, whatever, Battle Royal they did once a year. And they would bring in all the stars from all over the country and for this one date. I guess those are supposed to be pretty good. But again, the same problem. I don't care if the guys you have in it are great or bad. It doesn't matter because you have the same problem. There's nothing to focus on. You lose control of the match.
Yeah, you see, that's what I pictured, though, is like a kid that would be so out of control. It would be 20 guys all throwing punches at each other and not caring. So I have this idea of what a Battle Royal is going to be like in my head. Get ready for 6 years. And finally, in 1982, I got to see my first Battle Royal. I mean, the level of disappointment, I don't have a word for it. It was terrible. It was a bunch of guys standing around, you know, very little action. So I'm going home. My friends are like, oh, you just had your expectations blown up too much. But now that I've, you know, seen dozens, if not scores of Battle Royals on tape or whatever, I mean, it's just a terrible match. There's nothing you can do with it.
But it's as you described it. I mean, you pretty much described it perfectly. You said, I picture these guys just in there throwing punches. Well, it's pretty much exactly what it is. But it's your image only lasts for 30 seconds. It doesn't last for the 18 minutes that the match does last.
No, and I thought, and, you know, it would be 18 minutes of carnage.
It's going to get old after a while. I mean, if you sit there and picture it for like 30 seconds, it looks cool. But after that, you're like, okay, now what's going on here? And then you'll have the four guys trying to get one guy with two guys on each leg.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the same bits. It's a terrible match for the most part.
You're right. I mean, I have yet to see my first good one. And here's another thing, too. And I didn't realize this until we finally had Battle Royal Night at the Boston Garden, I want to say 83. They would hype this thing up, and they would say something like, you know, this is going to be the second or third match on the card. And then after the Battle Royal, the promoters will scramble to assemble whoever is able-bodied enough to wrestle another match. In other words, the promoter's like, okay, you know, a bunch of guys are going to get really badly hurt in this thing, and we're not booking anything until we see who's capable of wrestling. And of course, you know, like I said, and everything is in slow motion, and then they put out the worst matches they could possibly put out. Like, it's always a star versus a jobber to the stars. And it's made for an awful night of wrestling. One match poisoned the whole pool.
You know the one way I can always tell there's not going to be an injury during a card? When the promoter said there might be an injury during the card. That's pretty much the one way you can guarantee it's not going to happen.
Yeah, by this point I hadn't figured out wrestling enough, obviously. They did one really cool thing with the Los Angeles Battle Royal, and I think they did this with the San Francisco Battle Royal as well. It was for a $20,000 prize. So, wow, that's a lot of cash. And the way they worked it is the wrestler himself would put up $500, and then the promoter would match the $500. And with 20 guys, that was 20 grand. So the wrestlers were theoretically betting on themselves. They had something to lose.
Well, the problem with a lot of these matches, and Paulie's as guilty as anybody in this, is that it's like all those matches you come up with that just look great, like the strap match. You keep thinking the strap match is going to be great.
Yeah.
It's never great. The whole four corners, it's because you're sitting there picturing, you know, one guy so disabled, he's dragging it never works that way.
There's exactly one finish to a strap match, one finish to a chain match. We all know what it is.
One guy hits, the second guy hits. One guy hits, the second guy hits. That's the ending of every one of these matches.
Yeah, they're 100% of them.
Now, if I would propose that maybe look at the matches that maybe don't on paper look like they'd be that interesting, but when you see them, it's like, oh, like for example, the old Florida lights out match.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good coming in.
It depends on who's telling the story. But yeah, I mean, yeah, if you build it up properly, it does sound good. It can sound good. But that's an effective, and it's simple, as opposed to something like a Battle Royal, which, again, it just always amazes me that they didn't, that fans would always bite on that one. Because, I mean, as you said, you only had to go to one or two, and you're like, okay, this is just not going to be a good match.
You know what? That's an excellent point, and I can address it. Here in the Northeast, during the Bruno, Graham, Backlund era, even into the Hogan era, they didn't do Battle Royals very often. They did them, Boston did one in 76, and they didn't come back with one until 83. So by that point, you've pretty much got a whole new audience who doesn't know how rancid this thing is.
Okay, that's true. Which territories did a lot of them?
Obviously the West Coast territories did them. San Francisco, L.A. are the ones where they had the famous ones, and they did them annually.
And I would defend those by saying that just the way they built it up by having everybody in. Because these were almost like Starcade before Starcade. You know, you would bring in a Bruno. You would bring in, you know, Ernie Ladd, Andre. It would be a who's who.
Exactly.
So even if the match stunk, it didn't matter. You get to see all these really, really cool guys in the ring at once.
And think about it. It sounds so cool. Andre the Giant is coming here because he thinks he's going to win $20,000. Foregoing all of his other opportunities, he's coming to this event because he thinks he's going to cash a check.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, the Battle Royal can only really be successful based on the story.
I mean,
these guys built it up in the West Coast, so it was this larger-than-life thing. It was just, you know, this yearly event. That's what they did with the Royal Rumble as well. You know, with the you know, usually a title shot's involved. You know, that's the best ones. But it's the match itself is garbage.
Yeah.
And you're wasting 20 guys. I've never understood it. It's a waste of, you know, people.
No, not really, because everyone wrestles again that night. So it's almost like I'm doing what I normally do, but then I'm also going to wrestle in the Battle Royal.
I guess.
You know. Another one, same era. Bruno Sammartino and Stan Hansen are going at it. Stan Hansen has broken Bruno's neck, and Bruno has recovered from that. They had a tag team match, Bruno and Ivan Putski, or however you say it, against Stan Hansen and Ivan Koloff. Then they have the singles match with Bruno and Hansen, and then they come back for a third match. It's Bruno Sammartino against Stan Hansen in a cage match. And they made this thing sound like, you know, I mean, it blew my mind. Wait a minute, you're putting a cage around the ring and these guys are going to fight in a cage? And then they explain, oh, yeah, we use the cage as a weapon. We slam each other's heads into it. It made it sound like, oh, my God, you know, this is going to be a Roman gladiator stuff. I cannot miss this. And then you actually get to the cage match. And I have seen good cage matches, even in the 70s and 80s, unlike Battle Royals. But, I mean, what an incredible letdown. It's two guys trying to escape from each other.
Because the WWF rules are dumb.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah, in a way, we were dumb enough to fall for their rules. Because they made it clear, first guy out of the cage, you know, the survivor is the winner. Whereas, you know, and then they turned it into, you know, Jimmy Snuka accidentally knocking Morocco out of the cage or whatever.
I actually like that ending.
They
it was different. Yeah, I get. Well, I mean, the first time I saw it, I liked it.
Okay, that makes sense.
It was something different as opposed to what it is always. Either some guy gets tied up in the ropes, or, you know, it's always something or something fluky or something stupid. It's the whole thing's counterproductive. You're trying to run away from the other guy.
Yeah. And
the
only time I saw a cage match where the finish wasn't just one guy. Actually, I want to take that back. There was a second one. The Bruno versus Stan Hansen cage match at Madison Square Garden, Bruno just felt like he had administered enough of a beating and kind of walked out of the cage. Second one, same thing at Shea Stadium with Bruno and Larry Zbysko. I mean, it wasn't Bruno running away from Larry Zbysko and getting out. It was him walking away saying, all right, you know, I've made my point.
Yeah, both were pretty good matches, too.
They were, definitely. And, you know, even though Bruno and Larry, I was going to say Bruno and Larry Zbysko on the surface might not sound good, but the reality is they had really good matches together.
Oh, Larry was obnoxious. Just a perfect guy for the, you know, I was going off on Bruno about something once, and he was described to me as the bouncer. You know, all hell's breaking loose. Okay, Bruno's coming in to sort everything out. And Larry's just that just obnoxious, this weasel who's getting title shots. And, you know, and the matches are just the same thing you always saw. And, he was obnoxious. It was fantastic.
I mean, and he made for a great heel even when he got out of the WWF.
But right then, it was the perfect setup for Bruno. Just the personality.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been like Tully Blanchard against Bruno.
Oh, that would have been fun.
Oh, that would have been fantastic. Tully was so obnoxious. But, I mean, Larry had that kind of thing then, where he was just completely obnoxious. And that fed right into Bruno. That's why Spiro Arion.
Arion was a different kind of obnoxious. He was just nasty. I loved Arion.
Yeah.
That's why. You know, but anyway, we one thing I keep forgetting to do is to talk about our Facebook page, the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page. Just do a search. It's easy to find. If you enjoy the show, I really think you're going to enjoy the page. And what Sean and I did this week, we got on our Facebook page and we asked, you know, okay, what questions do you guys have? What would you like us to discuss this week? So we will get in as many as we can. Where should I start? Let me see. Okay. Rick Nathan asks, what if Bret Hart reworked his contract and stayed in the WWF? Sean, what do you think?
You don't have Mr. McMahon.
Very true.
I mean, that's the best heel they've had in ages.
Possibly ever.
Yeah. So, A, you don't have Mr. McMahon. I mean, overall, it was the right move. I mean, he got crap about it, but it ended up being the right move because it basically it allowed guys to develop who needed to develop, who needed to start moving up. It kind of opened up a logjam there.
Yeah, and you know what? You brought up a really good point. One cannot discuss the greatest heels of all time without discussing Mr. McMahon. And how many times has WWE tried to redo the Mr. McMahon angle? Too many times, bud.
Brett was worth more money to them leaving.
You know what? I have to agree. In order to frame this question, you might have to ask yourself, you know, what if Vince McMahon still wanted Bret Hart and wanted him to remain in the WWF? Because it was pretty clear from that documentary, which the name of it escapes me, the one about the Montreal Screwjob. Do you know it?
Wrestling with Shadows?
That was it. Thank you. It's been too long since I've seen that. Wrestling with Shadows, and it clearly made it look like Bret felt like he was being pushed out. He was unwanted. And I think I really believe Vince just didn't want Bret in the mix. He was going to go in a different direction as far as the kind of wrestling he was presenting. Bret was very hesitant to go in that direction. Vince was more of a Shawn Michaels guy than a Bret Hart guy, and I think Vince knew one of them had to go, and the one of them was Bret.
That's your other problem, is you mm-hmm. think Bret's working in that where they were going? Do you think Bret was hanging with them?
No, absolutely not.
And even
Bret would've gotten
in the way. The only way he works is if he heals, and he wouldn't heal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. He was a heel technically, except he was a babyface everywhere but the United States, which was really
right.
interesting.
Which
but
is, yeah, that's the only reason he agreed
so
to do it. It was. He said basically said it himself. The only reason he agreed to do it.
Yeah.
Was because he was basically a face everywhere else, and it was in America where he was just a heel. And like,
yeah.
as you just said, that's only going to work for so long.
No, exactly. And
he was in the
it
way.
It was fun while it lasted.
Yes,
but by the time it went away, it was time for it to go away.
That was pretty much the perfect time for him to go.
And you know what? I mean, Bret, I read his book. It sounded like he was absolutely miserable in WCW. But at the same time, when you're making like $60,000 a week or whatever it worked out to be, I mean, you got to take some solace in cashing those checks. And maybe the WWF would have given him that kind of money, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, that you had to get that salary off the books. You know,
now,
he did them a favor.
He did. They did themselves a favor. It all worked
and
out.
They capitalized on it. You know, he got taken care of with that contract as far as financially goes. They got taken care of by having that off their books and by basically clearing out a log jam at the top of the cards.
Yeah. One other thing, too. If I was Vince McMahon, after that whole thing happened, they did the screw job and Bret punched Vince in the face. If I were Vince, I would have had someone who got along with Bret, Patterson, I guess, I don't know. Call Bret, give him a couple of weeks to cool off. Or better yet, if I was Bret's agent, I would have been like, Bret, you are not signing another contract with WCW. You are coming back here in 3 years. And if Bret didn't like it, I'd be like, no, Bret, you're doing it. Because it would have been a 3-year countdown to Bret coming back to the WWF. And there was so much money in that. I know Bret didn't want to do it. And by the time WCW was done with him, he couldn't do it because of his concussion issues. But he did sign an extension during that 3-year period. And if I was his agent, I would not have let him do it.
Yeah, but it would have been a big money angle. But again, it would have been short-lived because you would have had the same problem you had before.
Maybe that's a good point. At the
it's
same,
it's not like
time,
they were toning it out of the act or anything.
Yeah, but To me, you could have talked to Brett and you would have been like, look, you know, never mind what's going on around you. You come in here, you be Bret Hart, you feud with Vince McMahon. You know, you don't have to come out with a bunch of strippers or whatever else. You know, you can just be Bret Hart. Just let us do the other stuff we're doing with the other people.
You can't be giving him title shots, or not many.
Why not?
At that time, you were top heavy. I mean, you had some talent. I guess you could run him in there as a break every once in a while. But I mean, you're rolling out Rock, you're rolling out Austin, Triple H, Mick Foley, among others.
We're talking about Bret Hart here.
Again, it's a short-term fix. I don't think he fits into the way they were doing things.
Now, I think, you know what? I mean, if Bret had been flexible, big if.
Big if.
But then again, I mean, you know, you have to look at it pragmatically. Like, this is where the money's going to be, Bret. You know, when we're not going to make you do a lot of the you know, over-the-top things they were doing in, you know, 99, 2000, 2001. To me, if it were something should have been worked out, but like I said, by the time, you know, A, he signed an extension, and B, he had concussion issues. But, hey, it's a what-if, so what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, I say it as a negative thing, and it's not. The guy was sticking to his principles, so that's fine. I'm just saying, I don't think he was leaving those principles.
And you're absolutely right when you say that, A, there's nothing wrong with sticking to your principles, and B, especially because Bret, frankly, could afford to do it. He had made a lot of money in wrestling, and he had, you know, just came off $3 million a year deal for 3 years. But at the same time, you're in business, and, you know, you can, money's a good thing. It never does anything bad to you. And, you know, I think that's where the money would have been for Bret. But yeah, I see the point too. He just didn't want to do it. And it dawned on me maybe a week after Owen died, like, oh man, if Bret was a long shot to come in before that, like, he's never coming in now. So you got to remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't really. I mean, it was kind of like Bruno. You know, didn't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know,
didn't
and
need
like
it.
I said,
I mean, I'm fine. This does not represent what I am. I mean, it's like maybe he looks at it the way I look at it. This isn't what I grew up on. This isn't what I watched.
Yeah,
and sometimes if the difference becomes the difference becomes that great, then, you know, it's not that big of a deal.
But you're also looking at, I mean, guys like Austin and The Rock, you know, the top guys in the WWF were all making well north of $1 million a year. I mean, Austin, I think in his prime was making, I think it was estimated, merch included, like somewhere between $10 and $12 million a year. I mean, I understand you don't want to chase it after every little dollar, but that's not every little dollar, you know?
Those guys were drawing monster money, more than Bret ever did.
Yeah. And the merchandise exploded at that period, too. I mean, I remember, like, 98, 99, like, going to a mall.
Everybody had an Austin 316 shirt.
Every other kid, I swear, either had an Austin shirt, a Rock shirt, an ECW shirt, something. It was nuts.
Yep. Yep.
So, anyway.
Stuff kept ECW alive.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, to this day, it blows my, let's say, 1980s mind that pro wrestling merchandise would be like the in cool thing.
Yeah,
I know some people are different. I mean, I could not imagine, and I mean that, I could not imagine going to high school wearing a pro wrestling shirt. No one ever did, and there was a reason.
No, never. And this was in the 80s.
Yeah.
So you're talking a big time for me. I mean, you know, the business was hot, and still you really didn't see it.
No. And like I would never.
No.
But anyway, question number two for my buddy Mike Fahey. Mike is a big Maryland Terrapins fan, and on September 1st, I'm going to be rooting hard for them against the University of Texas. Mike Fahey asked, if you could rebook any given year in a territory, which would it be, and what would you have done? Big question.
I have two. So,
okay,
I mean,
go ahead.
Well, the first is for, this is basically the end of it, but you disagree with me on this, but I don't care. I'm sticking with it. The end of 1984 Starrcade, I have Wahoo against Rick.
Okay.
I mean, that was the great feud all year long.
And Wahoo was a legend out there, and by this point, so was Flair.
And most of their business was down south, and everybody knew Wahoo down south.
Yep, Wahoo was a household name, no question. I mean, I like the Starrcade that they did, but the Starrcade that you're laying out absolutely would have worked.
I think it would have worked. I think it would have done better, because that was a hot, hot feud with him and Tully Blanchard acting as the resident weasel. While, you know, with, who was it, Rick and, who was with Rick? Was it Ricky Steamboat?
Yes. Oh, no, yeah. It was Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes for a while, and then Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat.
Okay, I remember the part with Steamboat.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's one. Okay, I would have done that, and I think you would have done just fine.
It would.
Because there was nothing behind the Dusty Rick story. I mean, that was great for 85, because there was something behind that. There was nothing behind that story.
Now, let me ask you this. Well, I'll tell the audience anyway. Do you know what the original plan for Wahoo was at Starrcade 84?
I do not.
Dusty was going to bring in Barry Windham, and Barry was going to play the role basically that Magnum TA played as the number two babyface and Dusty's sidekick and, you know, the guy who was the future. And Starrcade 84, Barry was going to wrestle Wahoo for the United States title, and it was going to be basically the birth of Barry Windham, Mid-Atlantic Superstar.
Really?
Yeah. So at least they had a plan and something. Barry went Barry, and he wound up quitting and going to the WWF.
Well, Barry comes into my second scenario.
All right.
My second scenario is that whole kind of from Starrcade 85 up until the Garvin win.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dusty should have gone over at 85.
I can see that.
Okay, that was too emotional. That was too built up. I could not believe he did not go over there. You have him flip it right back in February. That's fine. I think you would have done just as well with those return. I know Dave Meltzer always makes the argument that they made just as much money on those return matches, but I think you make as much money on the return matches seeing Flair trying to get it back.
You're right.
So
yeah,
I would have started. Oh, go ahead.
I've said for years that when Dusty won the title at the Great American Bash, I thought he should have gotten a real run with the NWA title. And this is, I know Dusty had gotten a little bit out of shape, and I know Flair was the greatest wrestler in the world, but Flair had been the top guy on, you know, in the NWA, which is on TBS for 5 years. And I thought it was time for something a little bit different. I would have made kept Dusty as the world champion. Probably until the 87 bash.
I mean, I would have no problem doing that, but do it in 85 when he was white hot. I would say have him win at Starrcade and have him keep it to the bash where Flair gets it from him.
You know, it's funny. I mean, Ric Flair is my favorite wrestler of all time. When Dusty won the title, I mean, I was in 86, this was, I was very happy. I mean, you know, me and my friends were talking about, okay, you know, we can do Dusty versus Rick rematches and then Dusty versus Tully. And then Big Bubba Rogers was a hot act at the time. You could do Dusty Nikita. I mean, there was plenty you could do with him as NWA champion. And I have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed when maybe 2 or 3 weeks later on Worldwide Wrestling, they announced that Flair had regained the title. And again, I say that as a huge Flair fan, and he's out there with Baby Doll, and I said from day one, like, that was not going to work, and it didn't. You don't want Rick out there with a valet.
Right. Well, for 86, actually, I switched that from Dusty, since I just gave it to Dusty, I switched that from Dusty to Ronnie Garvin. Give it to Garvin right there. Garvin was much more over in 86.
He was, I will say that. I still don't think he was over enough to put the belt on.
Oh, I think so. Oh, I think so.
I
think, yeah. When he was main eventing with Rick, and it wasn't one of those things where you're like, oh, no chance. I mean, Ronnie was over. I mean, he had those great matches with Tully.
Yeah.
On TV where they were just beating the crap out of each other. You know, with those chops and everything back and forth. Oh no, Ronnie was, and then he came over, didn't he pin Flair on TV?
Yeah. I mean, not in a match, but one of those things where I think came in. Yeah, you know what? We agree to disagree. I always saw Ronnie Garvin not at the Dusty, Magnum, Nikita as a babyface level. I always saw him more like Manny Fernandez, Jimmy Garvin level.
I agree with the first part of your statement. I don't put him there either because those are uber stars. But I have him as 1A. He sneaks into the main event back then on a good amount of times, whether it be a tag match or something. He's certainly bigger than, I mean, he ended up where Manny is, but I mean, in 86, he was main event in cards.
Here's the thing, and this is a big problem, and I just thought of this. In 1985, on your flagship show, the WTBS show, yeah, with a little help from Tully Blanchard, but Ron Garvin got pinned by Black Bart. Like, that was the push he was getting, and a year later, you know, 2 years later, they're putting the world title on him. They needed to do more to build him up.
Well, I thought he was built up fine in 86, and that's a perfect spot for it, because you were just – I agree, Dusty should have had a longer reign there, but if you have Ronnie Garvin there, A, it justifies the 80s, the whole bash thing, because their big thing was there's no way Flair could get through it. And he couldn't. You had to have someone who dropped the belt there somewhere. Because it was against, like, your entire babyface roster.
Yeah.
So if he rolls through the babyface roster, then your whole roster is toast.
I agree. When I was watching that in 86, and they were like, Flair's going to have, I think they said 13 different opponents. My take was, you know, and I wasn't, like, reading The Observer or anything. I was just a long-term wrestling fan. I was like, Rick's dropping the belt, and I can't see anyone winning it not named Dusty Rhodes. And I figured that one out for once.
There's the problem. Now you get to – but if you have Ronnie Garvin do it there, you're going to have him lose it pretty soon anyway. But it justifies that point of, you know, any given Sunday.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. That, you know, anything can happen.
It's a short reign anyway, so who cares?
Yeah, and Garvin, if he lost it, that the problem was if they had said, you know, Ronnie Garvin beat Ric Flair at the Great American Bash, I would have known right away that Flair was winning it back within 30 days. And you know, obviously I would have been right. Even with Dusty, he was getting it back.
Even with Dusty, he got it back quick anyway, so you might as well have it be someone different.
So my thing, if I could rebook any given year in a territory, it's actually kind of simple. If I could rebook anything, any territory, any year, I simply would have moved Andre the Giant's heel turn and WrestleMania match against Hogan a year earlier. I've always thought that WrestleMania 2 stood out poorly against WrestleMania 1 and 3. It was like something they very hastily threw together. I never bought Bundy as a genuine, like, WrestleMania level opponent for Hogan, and they had already gone around the horn with Hulk Hogan against King Kong Bundy before WrestleMania 2. Now, a lot of it, obviously, you know, can Andre do it? Is he physically okay to do it? I mean, he was still on the road wrestling every night in 86, so the answer there is yes. I think that was the year he took the summer off to do the Princess Bride or the spring, and I know that was very important to him. Well, fine. He took time off after WrestleMania 3. And you would have had that huge event that would have established the WWF as a pay-per-view force a year earlier. And I think a lot of guys would have looked at that, just as a lot of guys looked at WrestleMania 3 and said, okay, this is the place I want to be. I would have done things a little bit differently. None of this, we're having shows in three shows, one in New York, actually Long Island, another one in Chicago, another one in Los Angeles. I would have booked Madison Square Garden, and I might have lost some money doing it, but it would have been a packed house and a hot ticket. There was some concern about them booking the Silver Dome in Pontiac, because even if you draw 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, it's not
bad.
Good. Right. No. Well, they drew whatever they drew, and it was a sellout. But I would have taken the safe route. I would have gone Madison Square Garden. I would not have done a Monday night. And I know pay-per-view was in its infancy back then. You didn't, it was uncharted waters. There was no handbook for it. And they just didn't know better than to, you know, to not book a Monday night. I would have had it 7 o'clock Eastern time. That way it doesn't end too long for the kids, end too late for the kids on the East Coast. Starts at 4 o'clock on the West Coast and everyone gets to see it. So that would have been simply my thing. That's what I would have done differently.
Sure, that works. I mean, one other, I definitely would have had something different because it almost looks like something they had in mind fell through.
WrestleMania 2?
Yep. It looks like they had something in mind and it fell through at the last second. They had a patch Bundy in.
You know what it looked like to me? I remember going up to Montreal for New Year's at the end of 85 and buying a wrestling magazine up there. And, you know, it was Wrestling Eye magazine, which was kind of a lot more insidery than the After Mags. And they said there was going to be a WrestleMania 2, which I hadn't even conceptualized. I thought, you know, WrestleMania was just going to be this one-time thing. So I actually couldn't wait to get home and tell everyone, hey, there's going to be a WrestleMania 2 this year. And I just felt like, it was like, you know, are we going to do this WrestleMania 2 thing? Really? Are we sure? All right, we'll do it. Let's throw together a couple of angles for Saturday night's main event. And the whole thing was just weak, I thought. It just – WrestleMania 1 and 3 blew it away.
I mean, that's why I kind of somewhat bought the rumor that they were talking to Bruiser Brody at one point. Because it sounds like they had Bruiser Brody or someone else in mind for that spot and fell through, and then they went to Bundy.
I mean, it's possible, but I would have thought that they would have had Brody in-house ready to go certainly by the time, you know, by the time Autumn rolled around. She can get to give the guy the correct build-up.
No, of course.
I think they should have gone with Randy Savage.
I mean, how much
Bundy?
What about Orndorff? Just move that up.
Yeah, you know what? That's a tough one because Orndorff had, even the way they did it, they felt like, it felt to me like they had just turned him babyface when they turned him back heel. I want to say it was August or July, whatever it was, June of 1986.
That's true.
They didn't complete his babyface turn until May 1985 when he did the Piper's Pit on the Saturday Night's Main Event show. So it would have been like, I mean, you would have turned him babyface, and then you would have turned him right back heel. And let's not forget, Orndorff was the guy who got pinned at the last WrestleMania main event. So I'm a little bit lukewarm on him, as much as I liked Orndorff.
Well, he had to take the pinfall.
There was no choice in the matter.
Piper wasn't doing it.
It wasn't going to be any of the three. So. Okay, I see where you're going, and you're right in your mind, in your mindset where you're sitting there thinking that if you're going to have a WrestleMania 2, it has to be as big, maybe even bigger. And yeah. So would Andre do it at that point?
I think he would have. I think Andre's babyface charm was quickly eroding away. He seemed like he was just, I don't know, he seems kind of like grouchy Andre. He was getting older. He was really getting out of shape. I think that if I had to pick one thing 1 year, I think this would have been it. I would have turned Andre a year earlier. And again, it would have established the WWF as not a fledgling giant, but an actual giant compared to the other promotions. So anyway. Okay.
Well, hold on 1 second. Let me stay on that for 1 second. Logistically, you're absolutely correct, but let me ask you, why did it take so long to get Bob Backlund in the WWF Hall of Fame?
There's a reason. Bob thought he had a run left in him, and I'm talking, and according to, I mean, Jim Ross is the one who said it. Bob doesn't think he has a match left in him. He thinks he has a run left in him. This was literally 5 years ago?
Andre, exactly. That's the mentality you're dealing with. Andre knows that if he turns himself heel, it's basically over.
No, okay? I don't think that.
Oh, I do. If he turns himself heel, the whole thing was the great babyface Andre, who's always a babyface for how many years and stuff like that. He's one of those guys. You even said yourself, there's some guys you can't turn.
You know what? 1978 Andre, I don't think you could have turned. I mean, you successfully turned 1987 Andre. Why not 1986 Andre?
You might be able to turn, but is Andre mentally prepared to do it yet?
Sure. I mean,
that's my complaint.
He was in Japan.
It's different. You can kind of do whatever you want when you go to Japan. That's the beauty of going to Japan.
No, I
you get
think
to try out different stuff, and you know, it's of course you're gonna be a heel. He's an American. They're all heels.
I think Andre, you could have said, look, you know, this match is gonna be a license to print money. Unlike last time, we have much more pay per view clearance. And you know, you can say to Andre, look, we'll turn you back in a couple of years, you know, it didn't take a couple of years. It took like 3 for them to turn him back, 4.
But, yeah, that worked out.
Oh, Andre by that point was shot.
I just don't think I'm not sure he had it in his mind that, you know, by 87, he's got to look at the situation and be like, okay, you know what? I'm seriously done at this point. I mean, I can barely, you know, the guy can barely conduct any kind of a match at that point. But before a year earlier, I don't know. He may have in his he was wrong, but he may have had it in his head. You know what? I got one more run left in me. I mean, that's why I brought up Backlund.
Yeah, that's true. Right. That's a good point. And you're right. I mean,
if he's not
going to
go along with it, it ain't happening.
You're right there. I just feel like Vince could have persuaded Andre to do it. One quick aside before I get to the next question. I don't know how many of you saw the HBO documentary on Andre, but I mean, how full of shit is Hulk Hogan? How ridiculous is that guy? For those who are unaware, Hulk Hogan claims that he went into the ring at the Pontiac Silverdome in 1987 not knowing what any of the spots were going to be in the match and not knowing what the finish was going to be in the match. Yeah, Vince McMahon was going to let that happen.
Oh, he's still doing that? He's adorable.
He's a cutie pie. Yeah, right.
Oh, that's fantastic. He's still rolling that act out? Oh, goodness.
He did not know anything what was going to happen. He's standing in the ring, and not to mention that Andre got to the ring first. But excuse me, Andre got to the ring first, and then Hogan came out. Am I correct there? I believe so.
Yeah, they had those stupid rings.
Well, you know what though? Like, I can understand why they had those things because
that's how good a shape Andre was in. Was that you had to have this thing to make sure you get to the ring.
Yeah, I would have done it even if Andre had been in tip top shape. I would have had those things. I mean, it was a long walk to, you know, from the dressing room to the ring, and the way some of the WWF guys, their steroid habits would have blown up like halfway down the aisle. But anyway, Sam Nord, longtime friend of mine. What are some of the most overdone cliche smart fan questions and complaints?
Work rate. I don't care.
Okay.
Again, the one match I always say over and over again that's one of my favorites of all time is 72, Fargo Green. Al Green. I mean, and these are two guys who, you know, I mean, if they could do a suplex, you'd be thrilled. But, I mean, the story was so good.
Yeah.
If you could go in the ring and tell a great, great story, how many masterpieces does Jerry Lawler have as far as work rate goes?
I mean, he has some, but I know what you're saying.
It's how he's a great storyteller in the ring. So is Jackie Fargo. So is Bruno.
Bruno.
He knows how to go in. Well, he knows how to go in and read a crowd and adjust your match to that crowd. Guys who do that are great wrestlers.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to get into like that extreme 80s fan that, you know, and I've encountered people like this, they literally see no value in Hulk Hogan because he quote unquote can't work. When I was around a lot of the New England indie guys in the early 90s, this buffoon Richard Byrne, who was one of Kowalski's trainers, this is the least likable person ever, had it burned into these guys' brains that Hulk Hogan was the worst wrestler in the world. And I'm like, what? And they're like, oh, yeah, but look how much money he draws. He's the worst wrestler in the world, but he draws money. And I'm like, I could name 50 wrestlers worse than Hogan without even thinking about it. Holy crap.
Has he seen a Kowalski match? I mean, this isn't exactly a work rate special.
Yeah,
if you see him with Bruno, okay, he moved okay. This isn't like it's not like you're watching a Ric Flair match.
No, to say the least. Kowalski, I have seen many of his matches from like the late 50s, early 60s, and no, I'm not saying he's Ric Flair or Pat O'Connor, but he was actually pretty good. But, you know, as the years go on and he hung on forever, I don't know how old he was when he was still wrestling Bruno in like 73, 74, but I'll bet it was north of 50.
He did what he had to do to tell his story.
Yeah,
he did what he had to do to tell his story. Enough. That was it. I mean, basically you have to be physically capable to do what you need to do to tell the story, tell the best story you can.
I mean, hey, the rest
of the storytelling ability comes first. Work rate comes next.
I agree. And you know what? What comes first is getting the people to tune in and then getting them to purchase a ticket. And I hate to sound like all, you know, like I know everything about wrestling promotion, whatever, but that really is the bottom line.
What do you think you have? Three judges, the Russian judge, the Japanese judge, and the Australian judge? I mean, what are you doing? No, it depends on how much. And by the way, if you ask any wrestler this, what do you think they'll say?
They're going to say that, you know, I think a lot of wrestlers now in 2018 want to go out and have a good match that is important to them. But if you had to make them choose between, you know, doing what they're supposed to do, making WWE money, or going out there on an indie show and having a 5-star, 4.5, whatever star match that gets praised over the internet, I mean, if you got half a brain, you're going for the former.
Well, yeah. You want to have a good match. I'm just saying you don't. It does not have to be an athletic. Doesn't have to be Guerrero, Malenko, or something like that. I mean, it's just not necessary.
I mean, we were talking about Bruno versus Zbyszko before as being a great match. I mean, those two, they weren't flying around, but they were telling a story.
Larry gets grief for all of his stalling. Larry was a heel. He was annoying. His stalling was annoying. That was the point.
I do know that, but I think at some point, you know, it goes from, you know, hey, you know, Larry, come on, stop, you know, it turns into the wrong kind of heat at some point.
As long as you're still getting, a heel has one job, is to get you to pay money to watch him get his ass kicked.
Yep.
That's the one job.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, look at a guy like Tim Horner, who had all the wrestling ability in the world and could really put on a good match, and he rarely did he get that 20, 25 minutes to actually do so. But at the same time, he just did not have any semblance of charisma out there. And as a result, he did not have a very successful career.
And Larry's act may be annoying, but look what you can build off of. Look at all the different types of matches you can throw at him. To this kind of a stalling thing. Play with that. Now you can roll out your ridiculous strap match.
That's true. I mean, I understand that, you know, where when the heel keeps running away, that's when you have the cage match, the chain match, et cetera.
Right.
And so that makes sense. The problem is I thought Larry overdid it. I thought he became overly reliant on just, you know, spending the first 10, literally 5 or 10 minutes of a match arguing with the referee and avoiding contact.
Oh, no. Yeah, he turned into Tony Alamori at the end of it, without question. I mean, there was the whole pantomime and everything act. Yeah, no, it got bad. I won't argue that point. But basically, why did it get bad? Because he couldn't do what he used to do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so he relies on the old tricks.
Exactly. And that's you know, so many wrestlers fall into that. They just fall into their old tricks and they don't realize that the tricks have gotten old.
That's when they don't have other tricks.
they don't strive to develop other tricks. That's the thing.
Yeah, and when stuff
comfort zone.
How many guys do you see? Take a baseball pitcher. The guy, all of a sudden, take Greg Maddux. All of a sudden, Greg Maddux's fastball went away, and he still had another 10, 12, 13-year career after that.
Exactly.
Because he learned how to do it another way. If you don't learn how to do it another way.
Yeah. All right, well, my over, and we talked about this earlier in the show, and it's all we talked about last week, but my number one is Vince McMahon killed the territories. No, he didn't. Come on. He might have hastened the demise of the territories, but there's no question in my mind, by the mid-90s, if no one had made a move, pro wrestling would have gone the way of roller derby. It would have just the foundation that it was built on. Okay, we've got this UHF station. Let's put wrestling on 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, and then we'll have a show at the Boston Garden. That was all going away on its own.
If these territories were putting up, and this was my argument then, it's my argument now. If these territories were putting up products that were worth watching, they wouldn't have got taken over.
That is true. And
that's why you think Memphis held on as long as they did.
That's a tough question. They held on, but it became
because they were providing a product that their fans still enjoyed.
But that's the thing. Like by the mid-70s, Memphis, they had low crowds. Usually sometimes they had surges, but for the most part, Memphis was clearly minor league wrestling that was holding on because they had that television show so well established. But even that didn't last forever.
Well, again, everything has a threshold, but I'm just saying, if you, the guys who went down early in the 80s, it was because the product was weak.
Exactly. And McMahon had something to do with it, no question.
McMahon saw what was about to happen. You have the internet, you have cable. It's not sustainable the way they're doing it at this point. To pretend that you have your territory and no other territory exists.
That's what McMahon did.
To have a guy, that's what he did. But okay, take like the act of having a guy break his leg in your territory and then it show up in Florida and it show up in Georgia the next week.
Exactly. I was talking about this earlier this week. Kevin Sullivan did an angle in the WWF where Ken Patera applied the swinging neck breaker to him, and it ended Kevin Sullivan's career. That's the end of Kevin Sullivan. Well, until I pick up a magazine and see that he's wrestling in Knoxville, I think it was. Or no, he was wrestling in San Francisco.
Yeah, that flying, that spinning neck breaker must not be so great, because I believe Billy White Wolf turned into a manager soon after, didn't he?
Billy White Wolf. He was another guy that I read about. Billy White Wolf was gone. Like, I didn't see him in magazines or anything. And then finally, the Ring magazine mentioned that he was wrestling in Hawaii. I'm like, maybe he's, going to a smaller promotion, trying to work his way back. And then finally, in 1981, one of the After magazines posted a photo of this new manager they had, Sheik Adnan El Casey. And he had a beard, but even as a kid, I'm like, wait a minute, this dude looks familiar. And I pulled out a magazine that had a picture of White Wolf, and I'm like, oh my God, Billy White Wolf is now this Arab dude who manages, was a manager in the AWA.
Arab royalty. That's how it turned him into Arab royalty. That's how bad the swinging neck breaker was.
It gives you amnesia and money. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Carl Wardlaw asks, what was the thing or who was the wrestler that hooked you on wrestling?
What is the name of Brian Last's show?
That was the 605. Actually,
yes. The original.
So you just
the TBS 605 show on Saturday night, 1985.
Okay. So it was the show itself and not just like one wrestler, which totally makes sense.
No, it was the whole show. The whole thing was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was it was like the best 2 hours on television. It was a little bit of heaven.
Yeah.
It was like the highlight of my week at that time. I love that, especially in 85.
Yeah.
I can watch him now. It holds up.
Oh, totally. I could see a younger person like looking at that. Well, this actually happened back when, this is like 10, 11 years ago, like the WWF, it wasn't all on demand. They had the WWF 24/7. And every couple of weeks, they would put on a new episode of the 1985, or it was 86 by this point, WTBS show. And one of the girls I worked with at the time was a wrestling fan. She was Jeff Hardy was her favorite, and she subscribed to that. And she was like, "How do you guys watch this stuff? It's, you know, it's all talking, and the matches aren't any good." And I just explained, "Hey, it was a time and place thing. That's what wrestling was back then. It wasn't, yeah, you know, all this stuff going on Raw, a 2-hour hurricane."
That show was done so well. I was even into Sam Houston and Black Bart.
Why not? Those were good matches.
I mean, everything from top to bottom, the whole thing was good. The way they, because it was revolutionary to me. I'd never seen wrestling like good matches on TV.
Yeah,
please. I've been fed with the WWF. That's what I've been dealing with.
Ooh.
You never saw the champion on TV. The matches on TV were terrible up until Saturday Night's main event. That's why that show was so revolutionary to us.
Oh yeah. Oh wow.
The enhancement talent is, you know, was not treated well. Then all of a sudden you see the JCP show where the, you know, the enhancement guys were treated well, and they always got something. I mean, Rick, my God, they better got him a nice Christmas present, because he always took care of them on TV.
Yeah.
Every one of those matches, every time he had a match with one of those guys, he would give them at least a couple minutes in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agreed. I mean, you know, I remember coming home and watching, and WWF had taken over that slot for, I want to say, like 8 or 9 months. And Mid-South had been on Sunday night. Mid-South was, you know, I knew how good Mid-South was, but I mean, that was an incredible show. And Watts had mentioned, like, you know, "Yeah, we're not going to be on anymore. Jim Crockett Promotions has taken over. Thank you for watching. We wish Jim all the best." And I knew what that was. It was Mid-Atlantic Wrestling. Well, I assumed that was just going to be the Sunday night show. And I remember it was the Saturday after WrestleMania, the first one. I come home, and I expect to see WWF wrestling. I see this guy I've never heard of, Tony Schiavone, and he's talking about how we're going to see Dusty Rhodes and Magnum TA and whoever else. And they go
with
to the
a special
ring and
main event of Arn Anderson and against Manny Fernandez.
There you go. Yep. And they go to the ring, and it's Ivan Koloff, Nikita Koloff, who I had just gotten familiar with through the magazines. And I believe I think it was just Ivan and Nikita Koloff. And I'm like, wait a minute, are we going to be seeing Mid-Atlantic Wrestling every Saturday from now on? And the answer was yes.
It was a beautiful – and by the way, compared to the Superstars of Wrestling show,
mm-hmm,
the Saturday night show was Memphis.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just anarchy. I mean, that was – you kind of always knew what was going to happen in the Superstars of Wrestling. It was the same show, basically. I mean, mm-hmm, just watch what they have. Even the ones in the 70s, which were a little bit better, are still, you know, the ones in the 80s are terrible. But just compare that show to JCP. Just imagine if that show comes on. It's like, oh, this is what I'm looking for here.
Yeah, I remember that the first year they were on, they did this thing called the Super Challenge Series or something like that, where every champion was going to defend the title. And they were doing stuff like they were bringing up Wahoo McDaniel and Billy Jack Haynes from Florida.
The Florida Tag Title Champions. Yep.
And
they did the whole thing to set up Starrcade. All those guys end up being in Starrcade.
Yep. And I also remember kind of thinking, like, okay, well, if we're going to have different title matches from all different champions, I think it started in July and it lasted like the rest of the year. It kind of put a little focus on, okay, the NWA has way too many titles. But it was fun seeing them bring in different guys.
No, absolutely. But I mean, but this goes back to my point, is that JCP at that point was putting out a tremendous product.
Oh, yeah.
And they were fine.
The first 2 years were absolutely magnificent. And then my feeling is that A, the talent got stale, and B, that Dusty just, you know, a booker has a shelf life. And Dusty had been a booker for a long time. I think he was just out of ideas. It happens.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, it happens to the best of them. I mean, I say that about every, like, manager or every, like, coach, is that there's just a certain shelf life for you. But I'm telling you, 1985, God help who kept me away from my television, you know, at 6:05 on Saturday. Because I love that show.
Yeah, and towards the end of the year, I'm not sure you were aware, they had They had the show on at, I believe it was midnight or 11, it switched to 11 o'clock at some point, but I think at this point it was on, worldwide, was on midnight on Channel 25, so we're getting that too.
Yeah, which was a shell of the Magnificent Saturday Show.
I mean, you know, here I am, 20, 21 years old, making sure that I am home at like 11 or midnight, whatever it was, every
Saturday
night.
And that
Saturday
makes perfect
night.
Sense to me.
Yeah.
That show was so... If you're just used to the WWF, you do not understand how almost revolutionary that show was. It was like Nirvana coming out of nowhere in the early 90s.
Yeah, exactly, and starting a whole new wave. But
yeah.
the wrestler that got me hooked on wrestling, and I've talked about this before, and I mean, a lot of people are going to laugh, but I was a minor wrestling fan at this point. This is, you know, late 75, then coming into early 76. If I had like something else I could do, like, you know, go out or someone wanted me to do something, I would do it. And if wrestling went to a commercial, I would change the channel, and sometimes I would forget to switch it back to wrestling right away. So I was a kind of a casual fan. And then one day they were having a match with, it was Crusher Blackwell and Rocky Tamayo against Billy White Wolf. There's that name again. Who is my favorite wrestler? And of course, everyone's favorite wrestler now, Jose Gonzalez. And they're doing the thing now, Blackwell and Tamayo. Blackwell was like a middle of the card guy, and Tamayo was like a step below that. And they're in the ring, and somehow Gonzalez gets knocked out of the ring, and these two are beating the crap out of Billy White Wolf. And this wrestler runs out of the dressing room to save Billy White Wolf, and the crowd is bananas. There's no way to describe it. Chief J. Strongbow came out to save Billy White Wolf. And I saw this guy for the first time, and it was like magic. And I really believe that, you know, and here I am, I'm 10 years old, and I see this goofy guy playing an American Indian, you know, with the headdress and all of that, and I'd heard about him before. And, you know, just this guy got me hooked. He captured my imagination. You know, within a year or two, I turned on him because I decided I liked the heels. But yeah, you and I very likely would not be having this conversation. You and I, this show probably wouldn't exist if Chief J. Strongbow didn't come out on that day. Yeah, that's pretty disgusting.
Boy. well, I mean, you know, it's. I never got the Chief. I just don't. I mean, of course, when I started seeing him, he was really old.
Oh, even so. I could see it at that point when he made his comeback in 82. You know, he's wearing the singlet to hide his gut, and he's just not the same guy. I think he was, by then, he was in his early or maybe even late, mid-50s, excuse me. And, I mean, Jules wasn't much either. But it was funny. I mean, I mentioned this on another podcast. Here we are in 1982, and Lou Albano, it's spring of 82, and Lou Albano's interfering in a match, and Chief J. Strongbow, who we hadn't seen in 3 years, comes running out. And we used to watch the WOR show in my friend's finished basement. And, you know, it was on at midnight, and his parents were two floors up, so we could, you know, I don't want to say make as much noise as we wanted to, but, and yeah, we were watching it down there, and one of my friends who wasn't even really a wrestling fan, he got hooked on Strongbow. And this is the ancient version of Chief J.
Well, I pick on him, and obviously, but I mean, there obviously was some power to it because he drew for a long, long time.
I mean, I could see someone in 2018, I could totally see, even someone in 1982 being like, what the hell is this guy? But, you know, whatever it was in the 70s, he had it. And from what I understand, his 76, 77 run was nowhere near as effective as like his 74, 75 run.
Yeah, that's another problem with Jay is the fact that everything seemed to be based on that early 70s run.
Yeah. And I mean,
because every time he came back, it was less and less outside of a brief run with his quote brother, Jules, I guess they were kind of over, pretty over, you know, for that, the beginning of that run. But I mean, aside of that, when else was he over?
I mean, you know, the three runs I'm familiar with in the WWF, he was super over, but he was over less every time. But the when they first started, when he first arrived or came back in 1982, the Strongbows were red hot, and to this day, I am convinced that they just waited too long to put the tag team titles on them. They had this elongated feud with Fuji and Saito, who I think were one of the greatest WWF tag teams of all time. But sometimes you got to strike when the iron's hot. They put the belt on Hogan right away. I think they should have put the belt on Luger at SummerSlam 93. And when they didn't, they screwed him up. And I think when they didn't put the belt on the Strongbows quickly enough, or I mean, they took forever. And I think that they, you know, they just stopped being over. They poured cold water on those guys. But anyway, we have gone over an hour. Sean, thank you for being on the show again. The hour always flies by, and this Absolutely. Has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. See you next week, everyone.
See ya.